Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we lead off with politics with former state GOP chair Jennifer Nasur and the Herald's John Nucci. We'll touch on casino chaos, a Republican gubernatorial primary, and a corruption trial where everybody knows your name. Then, do you suffer from Sunday neurosis? When we explain it, I'll bet you do. Then we'll take your calls.
Reverend Irene Monroe and Emmett Price on NBA owners Donald Sterling now declaring he's not a racist, and Italy's spectacular singing nun will debate with you the SJC's decision to keep Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, and famed writer Michael Pollan, author of Omnivore's Dilemma and now Cooked. He's here to tell us how to keep cooking and why we should. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, WGBH 89.7. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim. You're going to give us a weather report.
I knew you were going to ask that. The answer is yes. It's in the low 80s, but sadly, the highs tomorrow will only be in the high 50s. But thanks for asking,
Marjorie.
It's a
trauma for us all, Jim.
Indeed. Now, for a state that doesn't have a casino, everyone from gaming chairman Steve Crosby to Supreme Court Justice Robert Cordy has been gambling with their reputation and their credibility. Here with us in Studio 3 to look at all the latest casino developments and other Bay State political news are Jennifer Nasur. Jennifer is the former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party. Hello there, Jennifer.
Hello.
And John Nucci is a former city councilor, a columnist for the Boston Herald, and he is now vice president of government relations and community affairs at Suffolk University. Hello there, John.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Good to see you both.
Hello. Good to see you both. So I guess it's fair to say, or maybe it's a total understatement to say, that there have been a few glitches in the casino licensing business. We all know the chairman, Steve Crosby, stepped down from voting on the Boston bid. We've had five Democratic candidates, Steve Grossman, Martha Coakley, Juliet Kyem, Charlie Baker, and Evan Falchuk have all asked for Crosby to resign altogether. Meanwhile, the mayor of Boston is threatening a lawsuit over the status of Boston host community. And you, John Nucci, in the Boston Herald, think that it's time to just pull the plug and start all over, at least on the Boston casino licensing. So explain.
Yeah, I think it's time to start all over, and only in the Boston process.
Yep.
I think there are other license decisions that this gaming commission can make. I think they need a chairman, whether it's the existing chairman or he steps down and the governor appoints a new chairman. They obviously need a chairman. You can't function with four people in a deliberative body. It just doesn't work. But the big picture here is that when it comes down to the Boston award process, it's beyond repair. You know, there are just so many lawsuits flying around. The rules have been changed. The deadlines have been changed. There are so many holes in this process that it just invites lawsuits.
And yeah, but they're not. But John, if it turns out they started all over, and you're not the only one who thinks this is a good idea, and you sound like you know that Walsh, even though you don't say this, do you know something we don't know?
No.
Okay, fine. If they started all over, he's laughing, which means he does know something. John, if they started all over again, everybody's going to continue their suit. Everett's going to say, "I was about to get it. You took it out of my grasp." Complied. Same with Revere. Caesars is still going to be angry. So you don't get rid of the lawsuits. You do end up with arguably a cleaner process.
And that's the point. You're right. You're never going to get rid of lawsuits. The loser is always going to sue in a process like this, whenever the process starts and ends. So yeah, there will still be lawsuits that will be flying around. But you will have a process that people understand. This time around, you can make deadlines be deadlines. You can make rules be rules. There'll be a better understanding of what kinds of things to avoid, a la Steve Crosby, how to make these kinds of decisions to keep the appearance of not having a conflict of interest. It'll be a better, more informed, cleaner process if we do it all over again. The same applicants can apply. And, there's a way to do it, too. You don't have to get new application fees out of the same applicants. You can let them apply. And if they want to walk away, the legislature can very easily make the fees they have paid refundable. Now, that doesn't go to the development costs that they've spent. That's part of doing business. It happens every day at the BRA. Developers go up there. They've spent millions on design and development, and sometimes they don't get the project.
Yeah, so what do you think about that, Jennifer? And you can also respond to what Marjorie said before. Your guy, Charlie Baker, is one of the five gubernatorial candidates who says that Steve Crosby, a Republican, by the way, should step down from everything, not just recuse himself from the Eastern Massachusetts decision. Where are you on both these things?
So number one, well, I mean, I don't know. Is Steve Crosby a registered Republican? I don't know.
Well, he worked for Republican governors. So I assume he is.
And that
you're
was
right.
A long
that's a
time
good point.
Ago
yeah,
now,
right.
right? So, you know, that's neither here nor there. I think more importantly, I think he recused himself, and I think that that was enough on this. I do think that the entire process is flawed, and it doesn't matter who you get as a chairman. You still have four board members who will continue on the same path as Crosby unless the whole thing goes back to start and is reworked.
You mean statewide, or you mean Eastern Massachusetts, as John Nutri said? You're saying start the whole thing over?
I think it should go to the voters in November. I think that the attorney general should let it be a ballot question. I think it should go to the ballot, and I think it should go and be all over again, redo it. I think Charlie Baker's first suggestion of having only one casino in Massachusetts is the way to go. Let's see if it works. And this whole entire process actually shows us that he was right from the very beginning. We should have only had one casino. And the governor is such a two-faced, you know, change his mind, go with the wind, because he actually doesn't know what's going on, because now he says, oh, well, maybe this isn't the right process. Maybe
But if you're going to accuse the governor of that, how about the guy who ran against him who's running again? We've asked Charlie Baker about 400 times, what's your position on the ballot question? And while he does say we want the SJC, which is where who will make the decision of the state's highest court to decide to put it on the ballot, we've asked him, are you going to vote yes or no? Well, I want to see how it plays out. I mean, it can't play out much more than it has. In terms of leadership, shouldn't he tell the people of Massachusetts, I'm going to vote for repeal and then file for one casino, or I'm not going to vote for repeal? What's he waiting for?
But I think at the end of the day, again, his first state, his going back a couple of years, he said one casino. So I think it would still be that having that one casino, whether it passes is yet to be seen. So if it doesn't pass in November, it's a moot point. There's absolutely nothing to talk about at that point.
You mean if it's repealed?
If it's repealed.
No, actually, but
repealed,
what he could do is he could say now, the first bill I'm going to file as governor, if you vote to repeal it on November and elect me the same day, the first thing I will file is a one casino ballot question. You know, do you think people are getting, there was a piece the other day, and my apologies, John Nucci, I can't remember who wrote this thing. Oh, it was the woman we had on Shirley Leung, that even the governor is getting buyer's remorse about this thing.
Everybody's getting buyer's remorse.
The poll numbers statewide are still a majority support casinos. That was before this most recent set of kerfuffles. It's going down. Where do you think the public is now? Where do you think, in light of the fact it will not be an open casino, even if they've awarded Western Massachusetts by then, there will be a slots parlor. Where do you think the public is come November?
Well, if you pay attention to polls, certainly in polls over recent months, support for gambling at the casinos has eroded. Mm-hmm. It's eroded a lot. I think in most polls is a very small edge to the casino industry.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's before the campaign starts and all the messages get put out there. You know, I think that Charlie Baker needs to tell the voters how he would vote on a repeal question if it gets on the ballot. I think he owes the voters that information. I think he should do that. But I'm far more concerned with the fact that the governor seems to have stayed out of this process to date. I don't think he can do that any longer. I think he has to step into this process. It worked for him to say until very recently, look, that's why we have a gaming commission. The process is playing out well. Nobody can say that with a straight face right now. And the governor has to step in.
And the governor's not taking a stand on whether Crosby should step down or not either, correct?
No, he's not. Not yet anyway.
But he just coincidentally, even though allegedly had nothing to do with the recusal, he did criticize him going to that
party,
at Suffolk Downs, the governor did, which is an unusual step for the governor.
You know, there's another little wrinkle in this whole thing. There was an argument, of course, before the state Supreme Judicial Court about this ballot question, and Justice Robert Cordy had a great quote where he was saying, 5 years exclusive licenses can be taken away with a big never mind, meaning the ballot question. You can do that, he said, without compensation. Wow. Then we find out that Cordy, back in the 90s, both represented and lobbied for Suffolk Downs and another gaming firm back in the 1990s. And that was a while ago. But it raises the question of conflict of interest for Judge Cordy. What do you think about that, Jennifer Nassour?
I think he should recuse himself as well.
I think everybody should just recuse himself.
Okay.
Wouldn't that be
okay.
the easiest?
Should he recuse himself for something that happened in the 90s?
Or? There's a different standard for judges when it comes to conflict of interest. And I'm not familiar with it enough to understand whether it rises to that level. Perhaps disclosure would have avoided all of this, but I don't know. I'm not familiar. So I think what Jim just said is the real issue here, is that there are so many things out there, just stuff out there about this process, that it would be a really good idea to just start anew.
Well, you know what I think is rather humorous about this whole thing is Cordy, of course, was the lobbyist and represented Suffolk Downs. Meanwhile, he's also was the senior advisor to Bill Weld, who represents the other casino interests in Everett. So you could say, okay, then Cordy's biased both for Everett and against Everett, for Suffolk Downs and against Suffolk Downs. And so is Crosby, because Crosby went to the party at Suffolk Downs, which people thought was absolutely terrible. Meanwhile, 20 years ago, he was in business with a guy that stands to make some money over in Everett. So it's like, is he biased for the Everett Casino or biased for the Boston Casino? It's kind of crazy.
There are plenty of judges in Massachusetts. Go find another judge. Why do we have to continuously find people who have conflicts? And oh yeah, by the way, you know, nothing on either Crosby or Cordy's integrity, but you're supposed to disclose this stuff. It doesn't matter if it happened 20 years ago. Disclose it, and then it's not an issue. But when you're not disclosing it, it just has a little bit of a nasty smell to it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there should be some kind of statute of limitations. Like Elena Kagan on the Supreme Court, she recused herself from cases that she was working on right before she went to the United States Supreme Court. I don't know.
But she was involved. She was Solicitor
exactly.
General. If you're actually involved in the case.
But that's my point. Do you have to recuse yourself from everything you did 20 years ago? I'm not sure.
No, but the point that Jennifer is making is whatever happened to full disclosure? I mean, the earlier sin, for lack of a better expression, that you and I have been arguing about, I think it's far worse than going to the Suffolk party. You don't, is that Steve Crosby, whom we all know, and I think we should say the mandatory, we have had great respect for through the years. Steve Crosby had a business relationship in the 1990s, one of the landowners in Everett, and for 10 months he never disclosed it, which John Nucci, I would argue, even though I was shaking my head, yes, I agree with you, start all over. This argues against it, because even if you start out with a clean process, you can't fix poor human judgment. What in a new process would cause a new gaming committee chair to disclose more fully? I mean, do you think Steve Crosby wasn't told in advance and isn't smart enough to know if I have a potential conflict, I have to disclose it? I shouldn't go to a lush party for one of the bidders? So why is that not going to happen again is the question.
Because as I said earlier, this will be a far more informed process if we do it over.
Because of what happened to Crosby.
Because of what just happened. You know, yeah. We all learn from mistakes.
Okay.
And the Crosby thing is you know, I'm not sure he has to resign from the Gaming Commission. I just think there are some issues, and I don't think he did anything knowingly wrong. But it was an uninformed approach to his duties as a Gaming Commission chair. Next time out, you know, the next chair or the next gaming commission member won't do that because now we know how these things play out.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, you have a starter marriage, you have a starter house. This is the starter licensing procedure, and we learn from our mistakes, and we'll try to do better next time, I guess.
Every time we talk about casinos, we try to tie it to the gubernatorial race. You've already done it, Jennifer Nasur, with your Baker one casino is a better idea thing. My sense is when the Supreme Judicial Court comes down with its ruling, apparently in late June, on whether or not the question goes to the ballot in November, whether they say it goes to the ballot, which I think would be, if it happened, Martha Coakley would breathe a sigh of relief. But if they decide it doesn't go to the ballot and agree with Coakley, I think it's going to be a problem for her, because the issue then becomes not will you vote for or against casinos because you won't have an opportunity, but rather Charlie Baker, assuming he's the nominee over Fisher, who we'll discuss in a minute, was for democracy, meaning your right to vote, and Martha Coakley fought whether this is fair or not because she believes this is what the Constitution says, and the SJC arguably agreed with her in my hypothetical. Martha Coakley wanted to take away your right to vote. Does process like that have any power with the voter, or is that yesterday's news come November?
I think it's definitely a talking point. I think it's something that I will be discussing the entire time from now until November. I think as Attorney General and someone who is also running for governor, this isn't her place to step in and to say, no, the voters don't have a right to
vote. Well, it's actually legal.
Well,
I'm sorry. Constitutionally, it is her job to rule whether or not a proposed ballot question complies with Article 48, which says what can be on the ballot and not. You may disagree with her interpretation, but that's part of her constitutional responsibilities.
But at the end of the day, it ends up that no matter what it is, no matter what project, it's going to be taxpayer money. And I think once you start talking about issues of taxpayer funding, of the police that have to be out there, of the fire departments that are going to have to be on call for all the extra property that's being built, for anyone else, anything else going through Massachusetts. I think then it becomes an issue for the voters. And I think that she is restricting the rights of voters. And so will it be an issue, though, for anyone else than us sitting here?
Yeah.
Will it be more than a political insider issue? I don't know. I don't know if other people will actually get it and hold on to it, but I do think that it's something that we will be talking
about. See, I think it's the best situation for Charlie Baker if they don't allow a vote.
I agree.
Because then, one, he can dance around what his position was going to be, because what it's moot. And two, he can say, point to that woman, assuming she's the nominee, and well, that's a big assumption at the moment, point to that woman and say, she's the one who took away your right to vote on whether or not, whether you wanted them or didn't want them, you should have decided, not those politicians on Beacon Hill.
Politics is not always fair, and it won't be fair to Martha Coakley, but the reality is this is going to be a huge problem for her if it doesn't get on the ballot.
If it doesn't, I agree.
I agree. This is a television commercial, and this speaks to the point of whether this is an insider's story or not. This is a television commercial that writes itself. You know, one person wanted you to vote on whether or not gambling should be legal in the state. The other person didn't, Martha Coakley. It's simplification of the issue. It's not fair, but that's the way it's going to play out.
One last thing about this. By the way, we should have mentioned, Andrea Estes wrote that great piece, I think, in the Globe about Justice Cordy. I think she was her great work,
it
as it always is. There were dueling Globe positions. What's your formal Suffolk thing?
Vice President of Government and Community Relations.
Perfect. Because obviously you have to deal with the business community too. Shirley Leung, the business columnist for the Globe the other day, said it would be a disaster for the business climate, the reputation in the business community for Massachusetts, if people repealed the casino law. And who was it? Was it Yvonne Abraham? In the last 24 hours,
said it's
ridiculous. Said it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, if it wouldn't hurt at all. Who's right, John Nucci?
Yvonne Abraham is dead right on that.
Why?
It's not going to hurt business if casinos are made illegal. It's going to hurt casino business if casinos are made illegal. It's not going to discourage anyone else from doing business in the state. It's a far bigger decision on whether or not something is made illegal. I doubt very much that auto dealerships are going to be made illegal in the future, or insurance companies.
Well, Tesla dealerships are illegal in lots of parts.
I don't think insurance companies and banks are going to be made illegal in the future. So no, it's not going to affect the business.
Do you ever troll around a casino, Jennifer Nasur? Have you? Are you a casino gal?
I'm not. No, I've walked through them, but I don't really, it's not really my thing.
Yeah.
I like
it's
fresh
so depressing.
Air. I like light, real light.
Yeah.
Natural light, it's sunshine. I don't know.
Why don't you tell them what you thought of the slot machine room and the casino in Connecticut, Jim?
Oh, we went because we were talking about a lot in our former
investigative
show.
Investigative reporting.
We did investigative
That's
reporting
right.
on a Sunday. And I said it was like a Civil War hospital. Is what it I mean, it's, but that was just that
tanks.
One particular
oxygen
day.
Tanks, yeah.
Really
in any
was.
Case, since you just mentioned sunshine, and since there was some Supreme Court justice who once said sunshine is the best disinfectant, that's a perfect segue to the next topic. The party that you chaired pretty recently but do not chair now has finally agreed to let Mark Fisher, the Tea Party Republican, on the ballot against Charlie Baker, so there will be a primary. Fisher has told me and virtually anybody who will ask, it's not enough. I want damages, which they say they'll pay him as out-of-pocket expenses. That'll be resolved. The thing that's still up in the air, and he is challenging Charlie Baker to join him in this request, he says, I want the tally sheets. I want the sheets from the convention to see, and I'm putting words in his mouth, if the Republican State Committee cooked the books. He said to me on the air, and I think he may have said this in his press conference last week, he thinks there may have been crimes committed, his word, crimes committed by the state Republican committee. And then he included Charlie Baker in the list. And I said, what, you accusing him of criminal behavior? And he danced a little bit, but at least he is suggesting crimes may have been committed by the state GOP. Should your former organization release the tally sheets?
I think that once they let him on the ballot, that made the entire discussion of the tally sheets moot. I don't think that at this point, I think he's just fishing. Fisher is fishing. He's looking for some press, and he still wants to continue to be the story of the day. And the longer he keeps this whole tally sheet thing going, it makes him the story of the day. But at this point, and even I think the judge had said, you know, what's the point of the tally sheets at this point? If you're on the ballot, you're on the ballot.
How about it, John Nucci?
I just nodded off. So, you know, talk about talk about an inside issue. I mean, talk about one of those things that's not going to matter one bit in November. This is clearly it. However, you know, having said that, I don't know why they don't release the tally sheets. There's no reason.
Let's think about it. Why would they not release the tally sheets? Well, why did the former lieutenant governor not release his cell phone records? I mean, generally, people in public positions don't release them if there's something there.
Something was amiss. You know, Hillary Chabot's got a great piece in the Herald today talking about basically blaming the Baker organization for not getting Fisher off the ballot, pointing out that Myhouse, who was Christy Myhouse, who was, remember, he was always complaining about the big dig, had a lot of money.
He was on the Turnpike Authority board for a while there, yeah.
And he had a lot of money and was very charismatic as a candidate and so forth, that Baker managed to keep him off the ballot back in, I guess it was 2010. Thank you very much. How come he couldn't keep Fisher off the ballot? I mean, he did, but now he's back on.
Can I just weigh in on this point?
Certainly.
Because
certainly.
I was chairman in 2010, and
That's correct.
Love the whole revisionist history of keeping people off the ballot.
Okay.
And I really would appreciate for anyone out there who's reporting on this matter to stop saying kept off the ballot. Charlie won fair and square in 2010. I had said to my host, if you can get 14.5%, I will push you onto the ballot. With Kamal Jane and Mary Connaughton, we pushed Kamal back onto the ballot. And Mary had a primary. Mary clearly won, but Kamal had even recently said, the party let me get onto the ballot. There was no keeping my host off the ballot. My host lost. He had 11%.
Yeah, but listen to yourself, Jennifer Nassour. Listen to your own words. I pushed him onto the ballot. If he had had 14.5%, which is not 15, I would have pushed him on to the ballot.
Meaning, so I would have helped him get on the ballot. I would have helped him get on the ballot.
Getting him more votes.
But we didn't keep him off the ballot.
But her point is that the Baker machine is not up to snuff. That's what she's basically saying. Because they did it in 2010. They couldn't do it.
Then I think the right terminology is that, you know, there was a flaw when it came to the ground game at the convention in making sure that enough votes, that there was no way that Fisher was going to get even close to 15%, because then he could have said there's precedent to show that 14.5 kind of slides on. Now, I think the rules were also reworked this time to say you needed a hard 15. But, you know, that's all up in the air. But again, it's a moot point at this.
Jennifer's right. Parties don't keep people off the ballot, but candidates do. You know, it's not unusual for delegates to move at a convention to keep somebody off the ballot. You may see a situation in a Democratic convention this year where the Coakley delegates are trying to keep Juliette Kayyem off the ballot because she could pose a problem as another woman in the final. That stuff happens at every single convention. So the point you're making, Marjorie, is a good one, and I think the criticism is a fair one, that Charlie probably should have found a way to do that at the convention. But I take the opposite view. I think the right move at the Republican convention would have been to let him on the ballot, for Charlie to take the leadership and say, why are we having this fight? Just let this guy on the ballot. He'll disappear as soon as he gets on the ballot.
See, now I think that should have been the party. I think the party should have said, we're going to let him on the ballot. Because for me, I would have looked at the convention. I would have said, okay, you know what? You're close enough. I'm just going to push you on. I think that's more the part. I think a candidate can keep someone off the ballot by getting the delegates and getting the delegates to them and not to someone else. But when it comes to the final determination, I think that that's the party's
determination. That. You know that. The voters see Charlie Baker as the Republican Party. He's the party.
Yep.
He's the head.
We're talking to John Nucci. He is a VP at Suffolk University. He's also a Herald columnist. Jennifer Nassour is the former chair of the State Republican Committee. We're going to get to the Democratic Convention in a week or two. It's in the middle of June. How many of the five candidates will make it remains yet to be seen. But let's stay on the GOP for a second. There have been some stories of late, which I have to say, unless you are a hardcore big-time Democrat, should concern you, which is it's possible the Republican Party is not going to have virtually any candidates for anything, for most of the congressional seats. There are 9, plus Ed Markey is running for re-election, for most of the constitutional offices, except for obviously Karen Polito running for lieutenant governor and Charlie Baker running for governor. That's a pathetic state of affairs for democracy, is it not, Jennifer Nassour?
Well, they have people out there running, and I think at the end of the day, you know, they were kind of a little bit sidetracked by the whole Fisher issue. You've got Charlie Baker at the top. That's really an important race, and you have a whole bunch of state reps, lost a couple last election cycle, and I think it's very important to make sure that all the state reps we have get reelected and there are more state reps.
Yeah, but isn't it true a lot of these candidates, apparently, for statewide office in Congress are not even have passed the signature threshold? And by the way, as someone who used to collect signatures for a living when I did ballot campaigns, if you can't collect signatures enough and the thresholds are pretty low, you shouldn't be elected to anything. And secondly, you can buy signatures now. It is perfectly legal. Go raise $10,000 and hire a signature. I don't like it, but it's legal. Right. Hire a signature collector.
I do not disagree with any of that. I think if you have a hard time, listen, it goes back to the 15%. If you can't even get 15% and you get pushed on, you're going to lose the entire thing. Don't waste your time, your money, or anyone else's time. However, that's, you know, democracy is democracy. So if you can get your signatures and you get on the ballot, that's awesome. At the end of the day, with the limited resources that the party has, we already have Tesei running up against Tierney. That's an awesome race. That's going to take a lot of time and attention. You've got Baker running. That's going to take a lot of time and attention. And you've got the state rep and the state Senate candidates. And I think that that really is enough. That's where they should be focusing
their resources.
I don't
think it's enough. And I have to say, John Nucci, if we wake up on the day after the September primary, 2 months before the general election, and see that whoever won the Democratic primary for attorney general is the attorney general because there's no Republican, or whoever won the Democratic primary for treasurer because there is no. That is really a horrible state of affairs for 3 million voters, is it not?
I agree. I'm a Democrat, and I agree. I think there should be a more vibrant race for these constitutional offices. It's kind of a shame that there's not. And boy, I think the GOP is going to regret that. If Charlie Baker wins this governor's race, it's because there's a climate out there among the voters that something's wrong with government. And that means to me that if there were some strong candidates for constitutional office, they might have won. You know, every so often you get these tidal waves that come in and who's there.
Yeah, but you want to know something interesting? I asked Charlie this question, or Marjorie did, maybe 2 or 3 months ago when it wasn't clear how many Republicans would be on the lower part of the ticket. I think the fewer Republicans on statewide tickets or for Congress help him because it even makes more powerful. The argument is, wait a second, you don't want one Republican in a position of power to check the one-party rule of Democrats in Massachusetts. That's a pretty powerful message, isn't it?
Don't disagree. It does help Charlie Baker, but that's not what we're talking about.
I agree. I agree with that.
We're talking about the fact that there aren't strong, vibrant races for constitutional offices between two parties, as there should be.
But the problem is that we don't have enough of a bench, and you have to start those people someplace.
Yeah,
and this
true.
Is my big thing. If you cannot go from no one to being, you know, a U.S. senator or being a congressman, you have to go from no one to being something. And then when you're something, you can run for the next thing and
That's
the
right.
next thing. And I think it's really unfair to put people out there and make them leave their families and leave their friends and ask all their family and friends for money just because they're being a sacrificial lamb, which is how I look at a lot of those positions. So I understand what you're saying. I don't disagree with it. But I think if your choice is being a sacrificial lamb or not doing something and having a whole bunch of people who are going to be on the bench for the next elections, then I think that's a better way to go.
A couple more quick things we need to get to. One of them is this. Everybody knows what patronage is. It's when politicians help people that are work for them or volunteer for them or gave them money get jobs. We've known about this for decades and decades and decades. There's a trial going on right now that alleges that what went on in the probation department went beyond that, where the system was basically rigged. Totally incompetent people got jobs and very qualified people were overlooked. Senate President Therese Murray, Senator Mark Montigny, her assistant majority whip, were named by federal prosecutors in the opening arguments as politicians who had a lot of people, including in Murray's case, a heroin addict, get jobs over qualified people.
And a guy who came in last in the interview phase, but go ahead.
Yeah, former House Speaker Tom Finneran has been mentioned, former House Speaker Bob DeLeo, with present House Speaker Bob DeLeo. Anyway, my question to you, John Nucci, is, first of all, it's going to be very tough, it seems to me, to get the jury to convict John O'Brien, who's the chief defendant in this case, who ran the probation department, allegedly ran this rigged system, when all these other politicians are not there as defendants. And is this going to be a really juicy trial with all these – a lot of politicians are going to be called to the witness stand to explain themselves.
Yeah.
You probably wrote a letter or two in your career.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
absolutely.
Okay, so you're the perfect person to ask.
Yeah. I don't think the public sees patronage as the problem per se. Mm-hmm. Most people sitting out there listening to the show say if they don't have someone to call, they wish they did have someone to call to help their son or their nephew or
so
something.
So should all the heroin addicts call Terry Murray, the Senate president, and say we need a job at the
well,
State House?
That's the second step of this. Obviously, people should be qualified for the positions for which they're recommended. No question about it. You can't argue with that. I don't think this trial is about patronage. It's not about elected officials making calls on behalf of an applicant. It's more about what happened at the actual probation department once that call was made. And I think what the jurors have to try to understand, and I think what the lawyers in this case have to do, is draw that distinction that we're not here talking about calling somebody on behalf of a constituent being a crime. We're here talking about what happened in the probation department when that occurred. Was the process they followed appropriate? Was it legal, or was it something else?
You know, my concern about this trial, I think Marjorie hit it exactly on the nose. I don't care what instructions are given to a jury. I'm trying to put myself in the place of a juror. And whatever the judge told me, I'm saying to myself, wait a second. We just saw 37 politicians who recommended people, some of whom were utterly unqualified. All of them are free to go do whatever they want to do, and we're going to send this sap at the probation department. I mean, I'm putting myself. So don't you think that's a realistic expectation of what a juror is going to conclude, no matter what the evidence is in this case?
I think, one, people have a real distrust of politicians and politics, and so it wouldn't be surprising to hear what they heard. I think, two, if you look at what O'Brien did, it goes beyond just the recommendation. So,
but you're playing, it's almost like playing lawyer, though. But there's an emotional aspect to this, which is what I think Marjorie was talking about, which, and I'm not disparaging the jury system, but that's a huge part of how decisions are made.
Sure, but I think it goes, you know, who wouldn't like to have, you know, Uncle so-and-so, you know, say, hey, you know what? My niece just graduated from college and really could use a job. What do you think? And so, you know, is it really grossly, you know, unable to do the job and incompetent, or is it just that they recommended someone and they weren't really high up on the list and they got bumped up to the top of the list? I don't agree with it. I don't think it's a good system, but I don't know if it rises to the part of criminal behavior on the part of the politician.
Now, this is a small potatoes thing, but the story in the Globe today really got me going. Marty Walsh, great guy. We all like him. But now, because he's the new mayor and Tom Menino's been mayor for 20 years, his administration is running around the city spending thousands of dollars on replacing the names of Tom Menino with Marty Walsh. On places like, you know, trash bins, the 12 big belly garbage cans that are around the city, or these office signs in different places, and signs going into the industrial district, and so forth and so on. This drives me crazy. You know, we shouldn't be spending a dime on this, in my humble opinion. It should just say City of Boston. Deval Patrick shouldn't have it either. State of Massachusetts. What did you have to put? Was John Nucci, is your name festooned all over the place when you were the clerk of Boston? Okay, so Marty Walsh, I'm sure he's a friend of yours. What do you think? Should Marty Walsh be spending any money putting signs up all over the city of Boston or not?
I don't know what the alternative is. If we follow your line of thinking, there'd still be John Hines' name out there.
Boston.
The fact of the matter is, right now, today, as we speak, there is a name out there. It's Tom Menino. He can't very well leave it there. I mean, I think I don't have any problem with him removing that name. I understand what you're saying. You're saying, so don't put another name up there. I just don't see it rising to the level of being something all that bad. How much is it going to cost?
We don't know. They said thousands. It isn't even a money thing. I guess it's just sort of, why are we doing this at all?
Yeah.
You know, why are we doing this at all? It's a vanity thing for whoever's the mayor or governor.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I absolutely agree. I think that it's a waste of money. We could find better places to put that money, put it into drug treatment programs, you know, put it into schools. Why are we doing that? And just have a blanket around the state and in
That's
the
right.
city.
We could be what are you saying? We could be hiring more incompetent people to work at the probation department. There's all that money.
They're on the side of public works trucks. They all say Thomas Menino, mayor of the city of Boston, all the public works trucks. I say, get rid of all the signs.
Wow. You know, you'll never see a mayor's name on the tax bill.
That is true, by the way. In Cambridge, you have the name of the city treasurer. Yeah. You do not have the mayor. That's an excellent point.
Okay, I'm glad I got that out of my system. It was driving me crazy.
Beautifully done, too,
thank
Marguerite.
You very much. Are you done? Were you done? I believe we are done.
I was just saying beautifully done to you.
Oh, thank you very much. We are beautifully done. And so is Jennifer and John Nucci. Jennifer Nussor, former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party. John Nucci is a columnist for the Boston Herald and vice president of government relations and community affairs at Suffolk. Thank you both.
Good to see you both.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to ask you what the dreary feeling that sets in on Sunday nights. You may have experienced it last night. German researchers say it's real, and they've named it Sunday neurosis. Do you suffer from this? And if so, have you figured out how to blunt its oppressive force? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org, stream WGBH TV's daily news show, Greater Boston. Meet the people and hear about the issues that define who we are. Available at WGBHnews.org right now.
It actually takes the average student 5 years to arrive at their graduation ceremony, but what goes into choosing the right commencement speaker? I'm on campus reporter Kirk Carapezzo with that story this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Ferguson Bath, Kitchen, and Lighting Gallery, featuring appliances for your kitchen and bath, including Sub-Zero refrigeration with built-in, under-counter, and integrated products. Locations at Ferguson.com. And Celebrity Series of Boston, presenting the East Coast premiere of Marc Morris Dance Group's latest dance opera, Acis and Galatea, featuring the Handel and Haydn Society Period Orchestra and Chorus. May 15th to 18th. CelebritySeries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We probably didn't need a team of German researchers to tell us that a sense of agitation and dread descends on most of us sometime on Sunday. But now there is research to back up what is being clinically described as Sunday neurosis. It's the gathering anxiety about the work week ahead. In Germany, this is because most people derive their self-worth from their job, and the longer folks are away from work, the more antsy they get. So the question to you is, do you get the Sunday blues? If you do, why? Have you figured out how to deflect it? And I guess if people are retired who don't work or don't work on Mondays, do they suffer from this as well? The number is 877-301-8970. Do you suffer from Sunday neurosis?
Absolutely.
I do too.
Absolutely.
And by the way, they say it's a lottery. The anxiety about work, there's more structure in your workday than your weekend. That's another possibility.
Well, that's a great point, too, that people don't know what to do with their unstructured time, particularly men. They have these lower life satisfaction values they talk about on the weekends than during the week. You think they'd be more satisfied on the weekends, but just the opposite is true. And
do you see what another factor is?
What?
Childhood anxiety, a carryover anxiety from childhood.
For hating to go
back
to school.
About going to school on Monday.
But I think my Sunday neurosis is not about that. My Sunday neurosis is about everything I was going to get done on Sunday, and then suddenly it's 9 o'clock.
That's exactly what I feel.
It's exactly. You wake up Sunday morning, you think, I have all day long. I'm going to pay the bills. I'm going to clean the house. I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to go jogging, whatever you do.
I couldn't agree more.
And then, suddenly there you are. And you've done nothing.
Well, we're two good examples, but we both love both of our jobs.
Yes.
So it isn't like there's dread about the work. In fact, it's the opposite. But I have suffered from this for my whole work life. We want to know if you do too. It's 877-301-8970. If you do suffer from Sunday neurosis or Sunday anxiety, I guess is the non-clinical term, why? And if you don't, why are you healthier than at least the two of us?
You know what the thing about unstructured time is?
Yeah.
If you have like a day off, unexpectedly during the week or something for whatever reason, and you have all day long. Once again, it's like you have too much choice. What do you do first? Do you clean? Do you catch up on your email? Do you catch up on your bills? Do you go to the movies? What do you do? And I spend so much time trying to decide what to do. I'm paralyzed. I can't do anything. That's one of the problems. You know what I mean?
I think I know what you mean. And, it's almost the reverse. This unstructured versus structured thing, while structured time is appealing to me, unstructured time is wildly appealing. I think the reason I have anxiety is I hate to rush. One of my one of the things I hate to rush. I don't mind. There's nothing you would ask me to do.
That's why Jim drives 55 miles.
Well,
an hour
no, it's because it's
on the highway.
It's the law, Marjorie.
Everybody else is flying past.
I usually am in the breakdown lane. It's true. Even when I'm driving, I'm in the breakdown lane.
Like a little
no,
old
but
lady.
You know what it is? It is the thing with me, which is not on their list. Maybe it's inside the research, which mm-hmm. we didn't have an opportunity to check. We're just reading about it. Is I don't like. I like doing things on my own pace.
Yes.
And as much as I love this, if you have a television show that airs at 6, you got to be ready at 6. If you have a radio show that airs at noon, you have to be ready at noon. And I think, I guess I would have less anxiety if our boss here said, you know that 2-hour show you do?
Mm-hmm.
Do whatever you feel like. As long as you do it on Monday, get it done. And when I get out to TV, they say, you want to do 6? Nah.
Yeah.
Well, then do 7:30. Well, I'm actually repeat at 7:30. Do 9 o'clock. That's the only anxiety I feel, that my time is actually too structured. But I clearly suffer from the Sunday neurosis just for different reasons other than that which the researchers came up with.
Yeah, okay. Did you get everything done yesterday that you wanted to get done?
I not only got done everything I needed to, I got done next weekend's things. It's of course not. I mean, everybody, you know, Friday night, I'm so glad you brought this point. It's a great point. Friday night, you say to yourself, you're a little guilt-ridden, but you say, I have all of Saturday and Sunday.
Exactly.
So I can totally sort of veg out or whatever the equivalent. Mm-hmm. So you just relax. And then you get up Saturday and you say, I still have Saturday afternoon. And even if I have fun on Saturday night, I have Saturday. And then it's Saturday's over.
Right.
You say, you can't take me the whole day Sunday. And Sunday, you start worrying about Monday, which gives you virtually no mm-hmm. space to do that which you wanted to do over the weekend. It is a problem.
And you know what the other thing is, too? No. We have Alex Beeman here all the time. He's a Globe columnist.
Weekly,
he
as a matter
like
of fact.
9,000 books and everything. And I am one of those people, and I can't be the only person. I love to read novels. But the problem is you read 2 or 3 pages and then you mm-hmm. fall asleep. So you find it's taking you months to read these novels. So I say to myself on a Sunday morning, okay, it's my day off. I'm going to spend an hour like reading my novel.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course, you've done that. And you maybe do a little 20 minutes or something. And all the things you're already like an hour and a half behind in all your projects.
Yeah, but see, the reason I, with all due respect, I don't think you should be participating in this mm-hmm. discussion. We're talking about Sunday neurosis, not Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday neurosis. Marjorie, 877-301-8970. These German researchers, it was published in the Journal Applied Economics, which I know Marjorie subscribes to.
I do, yes, I do.
Highlighted in the April issue of the Harvard Business Review as well. This whole thing that Sunday, for all these reasons we mentioned, causes this real condition apparently called Sunday neurosis or anxiety. Let's go to Dave in Rhode Island to start things off. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for the call, Dave. Hi.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
First of all, I got to tell you a quickie thing. I enjoy your show so much. The other day I was driving home from work, and I was listening, and I was very entertained. And I suddenly found myself with a big smile on my face about the conversation you were having. So,
wow,
really?
That is really nice,
oh.
Dave.
Wow.
Just, yeah, no, half the time I'm not interested in what you're talking about. Wait a minute. But what I like is how the two of you go at the characters that you're interviewing.
Whoa.
There you go.
That's what I'm tickled about.
Dave, are you like a radio reviewer, or what do you do for a living?
I'm actually a university professor at one of the local universities.
Oh. Really? Good for you.
In the Department of Psychology, if Ooh. That gives you a clue.
Well, that's also, that's a perfect entree to what we are talking about, whether you're interested or
yeah.
not. Is there, do you suffer from it, and do you know people who do?
Funny you should say that. Last night, I didn't know what to do with myself.
Mm.
I was walking all pacing and so on. The neighbor I usually hangs out with was out for the day.
Yeah.
My kids had already come through and wished my mom her Mother's Day and, you know, so on. And I said, I need something to do here. Now, I will tell you, as far as I'm concerned, Sunday is not for doing stuff, Marjorie.
It's not?
No.
What's it for?
Sunday is for relaxing. I'm sorry.
Okay.
The only thing I do on Sunday is because I love to cook as a, you know, it's my hobby. I make a nice breakfast. I make a nice lunch. That's it. Don't call me to ask me for anything. Don't email me. You want information, et cetera. No. Fact.
Okay, you know, here's the deal.
On my patio,
mm-hmm.
and I'm finishing up grades for the semester.
But, you know, you said a great thing, because I remember we had this conversation before with somebody that was promoting a Sabbath day,
yeah.
Either Saturday or Sunday, when you did just what you just said, nothing but relaxing, and how great it was and how we'd all be better off if we did that. You're probably right. I'm too nervous to do nothing all day long on Sunday because I worked the other days. I guess that's it.
But, Dave, thanks for that. And, by the way, Dave, you should stick around, because at the end of the show we have the great Michael Pollan, who has written a book called Cooked, which is about home cooking. So it's right up your alley. Dave, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. But you know what's interesting? When I'm hearing him say he watched a movie last night and relaxed and cooked, and you said that's a great idea, doesn't that cause you a little anxiety, the thought of Monday is approaching? You have interviews you have to do. You have reading you have to do for work. Last night we both watched. I assume you watched last. I watched last night.
Frontline.
It
was great.
We're going to be talking tomorrow. Michael Kirk, who's done this great, the United States of Secrets,
fantastic.
About the NSA.
It's enraging.
And that's in part because you want to be prepared for the next day, right?
Right.
I mean, it happened to be very entertaining, and entertaining is probably a poor choice of words, but it was a work-related thing because you didn't want to get behind when the week started.
Well, here's the thing. If you were watching the Frontline thing, which we needed to do for work, you didn't feel guilty about it because you needed
that's
to do it
good,
for
that's
work.
That's a very good point.
If you were sitting
that's
down instead and watching the next episode of Fargo or Mad Men, you would think of all the other things that you should be doing, because in my case, I am perpetually, you know, behind the eight ball, as it were.
Should I feel guilty at all that I watched 7 episodes of Veep this weekend? By the way, if people want a good comedy, next time we talk to Bob Thompson, Veep with Julia Louis-Dreyfus is one of the funniest half hours.
You didn't watch 7.
Oh, yes, I did.
You did?
7. Not
be
6,
ashamed of yourself.
Not 8, 7.
Shame
Let's go to Patrick. You're in Salem. We're talking about Sunday neurosis, which apparently actually exists. Hey there, Patrick.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hey.
Hello, Patrick.
Hello. Well, in my situation, I used to get the Sunday blues very badly, but when I started working for myself about 15 years ago, they practically disappeared, and it was a definite feeling of dread that probably kicked in after 5 or 6, and almost to the point where you couldn't really do much except sit there and obsess maybe a bit. And that's how badly it affected me. But, you know, like I said, when I started working for myself, I think I had more self-direction and more control, and then it disappeared.
So you dreaded going to work the next morning?
It wasn't dreading work. It was actually going through the process, the ritual of winding the weekend down.
Oh.
You know, feeling that sense of you're running out of time, maybe I haven't read the Sunday papers. It wasn't a sense of dread so much as it would just make me sit there and do a bit less. And
that
is fine too.
Can I say you've stated it far better than I did.
It is
totally not dread of work, at least in our cases, because we both love what we do. It is because you have to start the planning process. You have to start thinking. That's the thing. That was perfect, Patrick. Thank you much for the call. Isn't that what it is? You're starting to plan out your week in your head, even if you're not actually looking at your date book.
Yeah.
And you're not looking at your date book because you can't find your date book. If you had found it, you would be looking at it and dreading it, of course. 877-301-8970. Is this not making you anxious just having the discussion? Because it's making me anxious.
Don't you ever wonder how it is that some people, like an Alex Beam, have time to read all these books, or some people have everything in order, that, you know, they've got all their... I remember going to a friend's house once. I was staying there when I lived in California, and in her apartment in Boston. I went in there, and everything was folded. All her sweaters were folded.
Doesn't that drive you nuts,
and they
though.
Were matched, and she had all the shoes organized, and the clothes were organized. And I think, how does she have time to do this? How is it everybody else seems to be able to do these things, and I can't?
Well, you know what's interesting? You know this, but I don't think all of our listeners do. Sometimes when you have a writer whom you greatly admire on the air with us, you ask them on the air, but always you ask them off the air when they're leaving or coming, when do you write? When do you have to, as someone who's great and prolific as well, when do you do this to generate this level and quality of work? And more often than not, with very few exceptions, aren't they people who have colossal discipline? I write for an hour at the beginning of the day, whether I have something in my head or not, I want to get a page on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
I mean, there has to be that sort. So what's the problem?
You're telling me I don't have any discipline.
But that's my problem, by the way, is I don't have this. It was like the conversation we were having last week or 2 weeks ago about working at home.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, if you have discipline, working at home apparently is terrific.
Yeah.
If you don't have discipline, you do what I did. You pull up your chair to the refrigerator and just sit there until you fall asleep. Now, that is what I did because I had no self-discipline.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Danielle on the road. What do you think about Sunday anxiety, Danielle?
Hey there.
Well, hi. I don't have Sunday anxiety. I don't make any plans for the weekends, and whatever happens, happens. And I have a laundry basket full of dirty clothes sitting in my laundry room today because I just didn't do it.
Okay. How did
but
you
I
get...
I did dump my underwear to make sure I could get away with that.
What'd she say?
You what? Did your underwear? What'd you do to your underwear?
I counted my underwear
oh,
to
you
make
counted
sure I didn't fall
underwear
through my laundry.
Okay. Now, how did you get to this refined place, Danielle, where the things you didn't do don't bother you? How'd you get there?
I don't know. I think I have a twin sister that I share a house with, and she's neurotic about having a list of things to do. And I think maybe it's a reaction. But, you know, like I love my work, and I don't have to really plan ahead for it. And so, you know, Monday's going to come, whether I've done things or not. So, you know.
So grown up, actually.
Well,
Danielle, that's great.
That's one of the points
Thank
made
you.
At the end of the story.
What's that?
When they say that you shouldn't waste your weekend being anxious about the start of the week because that's what Monday's for.
Yeah, but
and you can get anxious on Monday morning.
Yeah, but for the writer in the Washington Post and Danielle to say that, it's just that you can't flip a switch and then all of a sudden stop worrying with an intellectual analysis. Just saying to yourself, what's the point of worrying? You're going to get the work done. The show's going to come at noon. You'll be as prepared as you can be. I mean, what?
You know, the other thing is they have all these books out there that tell you, you know, Habits of Seven Highly Effective People and how to get organized and take control of your life. But you feel like reading the books, they're so
you have no time to read the books. That's
well,
part of the problem.
And they're so long. You know, you just need 10 points. That's what you need, 10 points. I've taken those courses, Jim.
But you know, it's an interesting
thing.
Haven't
really worked.
One of the ways to deal with this, a la the last paragraph in Danielle, is say to yourself, I'm not going to worry about what the week. Could you do that next Sunday? Could you take it as an assignment and just say, I'm not going to worry about what happens. Monday morning, I'll come in fresh. I'll work like crazy, and I'll be fully prepared, and everything will be fine. You can't do
that?
No,
I cannot do that.
I don't
because I know I'll come in Monday morning, and I won't be fully prepared.
It'll be
and it
fine.
Won't go well at all.
Yes, it will. Terry, you're in New Hampshire. You're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about Sunday neurosis. Hey there, Terry.
Hi there, guys.
Hi.
I have the best schedule in the world. I work full time, but I have every Monday and Tuesday off. I love it. However, I still have that feeling Sunday evening, that kind of neuroses. It's like palpable in my home. It drives me crazy. And then I have to remind myself, wait a minute, tomorrow's your day off. But like right now, guys, I'm sitting in front of a big medical office building because I have to go in and pick up my kids' contacts. So I still have like a list of things to do on my days off. But I kind of feel, you know what? It's my list. It's things that I need to get done. It's not in the workplace, but it's funny. I still get that feeling Sunday evening. It might be also I still have a kid in school, so I'm like, all right, what is he doing tomorrow?
Yes.
Track, and, you know, he's a great kid, but he's disorganized, of course. And I'm like, I got to make sure he's got his track clothes. They're clean. They're on the counter, so he remembers to take them. So I think that's the Sunday evening.
Joanne, do you get nervous on Tuesday night, too?
You know what? I sometimes do, but it's all my own doing. I'm like you, Marjorie. I'm organized. Tuesday evening, what am I doing? At 9 o'clock at night, standing up at my kitchen island, making my lunch. Because I don't like to buy lunch. I like to eat my food, so there I am at 9 p.m., like, didn't do it all day. So, yes, I have to say I have it Tuesday evening, but knowing it's Tuesday and not Sunday, for some reason, it's a little more tolerable.
Hey, Terry, before you go away, what's your best Wednesday lunch?
My best Wednesday lunch. It's amazing what I bring to lunch. It's usually a big vat of fruit. A vat meaning I'm talking about a big size Tupperware of fruit, salad, yogurt, cottage cheese. I'm just thinking of all the things I bring to work.
I don't know if that qualifies as lunch in my book, Terry, but thank you.
Terry,
thanks
and
for the
Jim
call.
Should get together with the Tupperware thing.
No, but
Jim has about
six Tupperware
containers every
day. But I would argue mine's a little more
little
interesting
elastic.
Than Terry's, you know?
Now, David just emailed. This is not a good sign, David, I would say. He says, for me, Sunday dread usually begins Friday afternoon, about a half hour before I leave work. That is not a good sign.
By the way,
say?
You know, you're laughing at that. That's what I was trying to describe before, is you make a calculation when you finish work on Friday, when I'm going to do what it is that I theoretically need to do.
Right.
And if you start thinking about it right away, which I do, it does produce some anxiety, even 2 days before it does.
You know, when you make your list, and they always tell you in these courses to make your list and prioritize.
Yeah.
If you make your list and you'll only do things 4 and 5 and you'll never do things 1, 2, and 3, what do you do about that?
You change the order of the numbers. No, but by the way, you know, I told you I took a one of those courses with the Franklin Daily Planner about 20 years ago where you prioritize things. it actually does work. And there's a real system. You check things off. You have a feeling of accomplishment, even if the thing you finished is quite minor as opposed to major. And then it becomes sort of a self-fulfilling. It feeds on itself, I guess.
But you have to get to the number one or number two priority eventually.
Well, yeah,
but that could be the problem for lots of us.
Because it's a bigger, more difficult
thing. It gets bigger
and
bigger and bigger and bigger. And pretty soon you have like 6 feet worth of mail staring at you.
Well, okay. I think, I think one of us is a hopeless case here and the other has a chance to be cured.
Okay, up next, it is time for All Revved Up with the Reverends Irene Monroe and Reverend Emmett Price. They join us for their take on Michael Sam's celebratory same-sex smooch, A Singing Nun. And that is all next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Can't find it on a map, but it's still home.
When the GDR disappeared, I, for the first time, felt touched by this country because it was so quickly gone.
Author Maxim Leo was born in communist East Germany, a place alive in his heart and in his complicated family's hearts even today. Red Love, a family story, next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for WGBH comes from you and Floor, providing custom area rugs, runners, and wall-to-wall carpeting with Floor Carpet Design Squares. In-store design assistance available at their store at the corner of Newbury and Clarendon. That's FLOR.com. Carpet is boring. This isn't carpet. And the Lincoln Motor Company, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2014 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. More information at Lincoln.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 for All Revved Up, our Reverend Irene Monroe. She's a syndicated columnist. You can find her at Bay Windows and the Huffington Post. We're also joined by Reverend Emmett Price. He's a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Towards Bridging the Generational Divide. Good to see you both.
Hey.
Hi.
Great to see you.
So Jim and I were watching this morning before we came down. You may have seen it before, Jim. I hadn't. The great video of Michael Sam when he was chosen, when he was drafted. 8 from the end, but drafted nonetheless by the NFL. I think we have some sound of that.
We should first say who he is, by the way, for the few people who don't
know. He's the first openly gay guy that declared he was gay before he was even in the draft. He was in college. He declared he was gay, said he wanted to own up to being gay. And there was a big question about whether he'd be drafted at all. A lot of people were talking about how he wasn't the right size and he was too small. He looked pretty big to me. But in any case, he was drafted near the end, 7th round. But Brady was drafted in the 6th round. So you never know. You might turn out great. But in any case, we have some sound to play of the moment that he heard that he was being drafted, and here it is.
There you see him on the phone, and there you see the raw emotion. We've seen this so many times, over and over again, for so many players.
So essentially, if you didn't see this thing, and you got to see it if you have not, this is, he gets the phone call, as those who are drafted do, from the team that are taking him. Drudge said, Sam's a Ram, and he is. He's playing for the St. Louis Rams. He starts crying right away. His boyfriend, whose name is Vito Camisano, who's a swimmer and a fellow University of Missouri alum, is rubbing his arm as he's crying. And then the kiss scene round the world. Starting with you, Emmett Price, my attitude is, I think this is huge. Yeah. I don't just mean the moment. Yeah. I think it is a transformative moment. We know some losers like this guy from Miami Dolphins tweeted horrible OMG and then apologized. But this is a major moment, no?
Yeah. This is one of those cultural moments where we look back for many years and decades to come. You know, one, you had a loving couple who, again, the cameras kind of infringed on an extremely intimate moment, which we're used to, and that's part of the draft. You know, we want to see these folks at the very moment. So you know when the phone rings, you know, get the cameras on. Come on, it's time. time is time. And then, you know, the announcement and there you are. But to see, you know, this, you know, moment, this intimate moment of this loving couple. I mean, that smooch, you know, I loved it. I loved it. I mean, it was great.
That's fabulous.
It was great.
By the way, if you had said to me last week, Irene Monroe, the word on the street is if he gets drafted, he's going to kiss his boyfriend. I would have said to you, ESPN will find a reason not to run this. But instead, here's Seth Markham, the producer. He oversees NFL draft coverage for ESPN. He said, we never had one discussion about it. What if he's drafted his partners there and they kiss? Honestly, it never came up. And he suggested a generational split over how much it matters. When I got home last night, we saw the attention was receiving. It kind of threw me. We're a young production crew. And quite honestly, it was just another moment in the years we've done this. What was your take on it? A big smile on your face.
I loved it. You know, I gasped for a moment because I said, "Oh my God, I'm surprised that they didn't, you know, delete it." But you know, it reminded me. The outrage reminded me of the Cheerios commercial. Do you remember the
interracial? Oh yes, right.
And people were outraged. And the thing is that I think once you see more of an image, it becomes normalized. But you can't ignore. You can't ignore a couple of things. One is that he's going to have a difficult time with the brotherhood. In the NFL, and people still have what's called the ick factor, and that's sort of any outward display of affection by same-sex couple, but also the whole thing about the homosexual gaze, the whole thing that heterosexual men have the right to control who sees their naked body, because if they didn't have that kind of control, it would disrupt team cohesion.
When you mentioned team cohesion, though, I think the best sign so far about this, and I'm sure everybody knows this who's been following this story, is when we finally heard from Sam that he was gay, was after a whole season playing at the University of Missouri, where his whole team had known for the whole season that he was gay and had not said a word, which suggests to me, Emmett, that if it turns out the guy can play, and I'm really crossing my fingers that this guy can at least make the team, that his teammates are going to say, hey, if you can make tackles, we don't care what you do in your own time. We're going to live with this. And if he can't play, there'll probably be a couple of remarks about it.
I mean, this guy was the defensive player of the year for the SEC, which is no laughing matter. It's not like the SEC is like the, you know, the junior woodchuck league of the you know, college, you know, football league. I mean, the other piece is he made the statement to get out in front of, you know, all the potential controversy and stuff. So he wanted to be able to control his narrative and tell his story the way that he wanted to tell it. And so, you know, kudos for him. And yes, it cost him the 7th-round pick. There's no question about it.
Absolutely.
Meaning he would have been higher in the draft, you mean? Yeah.
If he had stayed in the closet,
it cost him the 7th-round pick. But that's okay, because at the end of the day, he's hired to play football, and he's going to have a phenomenal year, you know, and we'll see what happens. And then, you know, the truth is in the story.
Let me ask you something, Emmett Price. How unusual are you? I mean, I think it's always been...
Do you really want me to say that?
You can certainly go into detail if you want to, but I mean in the sense of, I think it's cultural. It's much easier to look at two lesbians kissing, and a lot of men like that whole thing. It's harder, and it's harder for me too to look at two men
to
kissing.
What, robust looking?
Well, it's just somehow
culturally,
it's
like
just,
you said,
it's
Irene,
just
it's culturally
to look at two women kissing. Maybe because women are more affectionate to each other anyway. It's always been hard for me. I remember seeing Romeo and Julio at Brookline High School, two guys kissing, and it was kind of like wow. And but how unusual are you? Because you're a straight guy, you're a black guy.
Yep.
And you're not very old.
No.
So
not yet.
You didn't have a oh my God reaction.
No, my theological framework is really based on the idea of love. And what does it mean to love? And love is not based on a double standard. And so if we are to, you know, in my mind frame, you know, to follow, you know, God's protocol, to love God with our mind, heart, and soul, and then to love our neighbors, ourselves, then we can't have a duality in that, right? And so Michael, Sam, and his partner, you know, those are my neighbors. You know, it's a hard walk because systematically, you know, we're grounded in our historical perspective, right? And so some of the trauma and some of the abuse and some of the oppression that we've lived through kind of frames our desire to think the other way. And so it's a daily challenge to figure out how can you walk a life of love
love. He is an unusual brother. You're so unusual that you know what? I'll give up my lesbianism and marry him. Okay? There you go.
That is unusual.
I just love him. it. Yeah, but the truth be told, I mean, part of black masculinity is really predicated on this whole notion of being a certain kind of black man. And what the NFL as well as the NBA needed, they needed some black hopes. Yeah. And Jason Collins and Michael Sam becomes those iconic image because, truth be told, it's so like the black church. Oh, it's not that they didn't have LGBT folks on the squad here. It's just that they didn't have anybody that was open. So now we don't have to play go away closer. We don't we don't have to be in that open closet. They're out. They're out, brothers. And it's a difficult walk, but I applaud them because they're going to do this walk.
Yeah.
Okay, let's shift gears to somebody who didn't act quite as proudly. Donald Sterling, the owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, everybody knows about his taped conversation with his girlfriend, V, finally is talking to a reporter. Tonight, Anderson Cooper has him at 8 o'clock on CNN. First listen, well, listen to this, and then we have a follow-up.
Has he done everything he can do to help minorities? I don't think.
We'll get to that. Let's do the one that starts, I'm a good member, if we can, for a second.
And I'm a good member who made a mistake, and I'm apologizing, and I'm asking for forgiveness. Am I entitled to one mistake? Am I, after 35 years? I mean, I love my league. I love my partners. Am I entitled to one mistake? It's a terrible mistake. And I'll never do it again.
And then in the same interview, he makes a second mistake, talking about Magic Johnson. Here it is.
Huge.
Has he done everything he can do to help minorities? I don't think so. But I'll say it. I'll say it. You know, he's great. But I just don't think he is a good example for the children of Los Angeles.
Okay, two reverends. Unfortunately, he made the second comment, which suggests to me on a serious, I think the guy, in all seriousness, is senile. You know, it's one of these things. No, I don't mean it.
I do.
I think when you basically are smart enough or advised well enough to say you got to go on and apologize profusely, almost in tears to Anderson Cooper, and then compound your problems by trashing Magic Johnson. But putting this aside, isn't there a piece of you reverends that say the guy apologized for his sins? Is there not a piece of you that says give him a second choice, suspend him for a year, fine him whatever the fine was, but he's apologized. What more is he supposed to do?
But don't you think he's had a number of passes, particularly? Particularly with his housing discrimination.
Yeah.
This is what I feel. I think this billionaire bigot is just unconsciously racist. And no matter what he does, whether his paramour goes on Barbara Walters or Shelley, his wife, goes on Barbara Walters, mm-hmm. I don't think that you can rehab his image. I also think he's somewhat homophobic because when he says he's not a good image for the kids. And we all know about Magic Johnson's enterprise, what he's done in L.A. Some of it, I think, is because Magic is HIV positive, mm-hmm. and also because he has, no offense, a flamboyantly gay son. So I think he feels like he just wasn't a good role model. And I think that's the subtext of what he's really trying to say. You're not a good father. How could you possibly be a good role model?
So no forgiveness out of Irene Monroe. How about you?
You know, there's a difference between forgiveness and then reinstatement and forgiveness and, you know, thriving as a business partner. And, I mean, the irony of the whole statement was the question that Anderson Cooper asked, who do you trust? Mm-hmm. who are you seeking, you know, counsel from? And so he goes into Magic Johnson and then clearly, you know, rips him to threads. I mean, you know, and as a young person who grew up in Los Angeles around the time, I mean, Magic Johnson's probably the closest.
Is this you?
Yeah, yeah.
You're a Los Angeles
kid? Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Magic Johnson's probably the closest you can get to, Martin Luther King Jr.,
during the early 80s. Jesus is a savior.
I mean, you know, in terms of what he did in terms of economic development, in terms of what he did for, you know, youth and for different programs and creating opportunities, even in the midst of dealing with the HIV and AIDS stuff. So for Donald Sterling to say that you know, I don't think kids should look up to him,
right.
That's ludicrous.
And I also think that it's an easy out to say that he's senile, because my point is, even if you're senile, if it isn't in your heart,
you don't say it.
I think how he could have really engendered sympathy. If he said, listen, we all say all off-colored things at any moment, and what you're violating is my privacy right. Well, I think on that
doesn't engender sympathy when it comes from him. If a constitutional type argues that, that's one thing. But when you were the person who was...
You asked me to try to forgive him, right? I mean, you know, I'm trying to give you an example.
Here's the answer. Here's the answer. And he said it himself. He said he's emotionally distraught. I mean, that's the issue here. That's what's going on.
Because he got
caught. I mean, you know, Donald Sterling is emotionally distraught.
Yeah, okay, this is the classic case of the guy got caught.
Okay, really.
He's sorry he got caught. I think he believes what he said. And
he has no sense of accountability.
Okay, yeah, Marjorie's about to get caught. We felt, for news purposes, we had an obligation to discuss Michael Sam and Don Sterling, but the person that Marjorie really wanted to talk about today was a sister. Here is, if you have not heard this, I never even heard of her until this morning. This is Sister Nun Christina. She's 25 years old, a nun, I repeat, singing No One, the great song by Alicia Keys, on the Italian version of The Voice. Listen. Now, if you have not seen this, beyond the fact that the woman can really sing and she's in her habit, she's got her little black nun shoes and she's she's dancing up a storm.
Well, crucifix swinging back and forth. Oh, but the best thing in the Italian version of American Idol, the judges all sit with their backs to the performer.
Oh, yeah, this was great.
And then they decide if they like the person that they're going to press on their little seat and turn around. And the expressions on their judges' faces, especially this rapper who's got tattoos all the way up in his arms, Italian rapper, he turns around and he sees there's a nun and he just can't believe it. And she's terrific. She's dancing around. She's 25. Doesn't hurt that she's a good-looking woman. I mean, she's just great. And you listen to her sing this, then you hear her sing a song from Flashdance and
what
girls
feeling,
just want to
yeah.
have fun yeah. and the dancers around her. It's so fantastic. You just got a smile from ear to ear watching her.
I've been watching this for the last few weeks on YouTube, and my only lament is that my Italian is horrible, because after she finishes singing in English, you know, I can't understand what the judges are saying, other than the fact that they're phenomenally excited about her, and they're overwhelmingly joyful, and to see her on stage, her vocals are amazing.
I mean, just
in terms of the techniques of music, her musicality is really special, but then her embodiment, the way that she dances, dances and jumps around. She's feeling it.
Yeah.
She's really feeling it.
Well, she says it's a gift. It's a gift from God and a gift to give to folks. She's the real sister act in many ways. But, you know, a lot of it has to do with the tone of this Pope, too, because it's not like she's the only phenomenon that hasn't been around since, 1961, when we had the big hit Dominique.
Yeah, that's right, Dominique.
And so, I mean, I just think that with Pope Benedict, that kind of talent couldn't flourish, given the kind of strictures and the restrictions put on folks.
I own that album. I just want you to know.
You do?
I own Dominique
and
Nika. Nika.
So I think what she'll do for Catholic music is what Kirk Franklin did. He brought hip-hop. He brought gospel hip-hop. We have gospel jazz. So I think there's a somewhat sea change in that regard. I don't think, unfortunately, there will be that much of a sea change in terms of women's roles in the church, because she's doing what she's supposed to do. She's just a singing nun.
But having said that, I was, and you're probably right, 100%. Of what you said, but the first 98% there, Irene Monroe. I was going to mention Pope Francis when you were done, but you beat me to it. I think things like that humanize religion and help bring, at least soften people up enough to say, maybe this is for me. I mean, don't you think, Emma?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the habit that she wears is part of her commitment to the Catholic Church and in the convent, but it's not her identity. She is who she is, and she has a special, you know, disposition. She has some phenomenal talents and whatnot, and so the individuality and the persona that she is coming out, you see that when she sings, and it's like, oh my God.
Yeah, but you know, you do have a conservative wing within the Catholic Church. Bill Donahue is a good example of that.
And don't tell me he's complaining.
He complains about
everything.
You mean
everything.
Here? You know.
Here?
He's in New York.
Throughout.
Oh, Bill Donahue. I think you're talking about, who's your nemesis? Every column you write.
C.J. Doyle.
C.J. Doyle. I thought you were talking about him. My apologies.
I forgot Donahue.
No, it's the Catholic League or something.
Yeah, and I mean, they find it sacrilegious. they find it, you know, that if this, then what next? Some of them are very, very upset by her movement. It doesn't seem, you know, it seems more secular than it seems religious. And I think that she really blends that schism between the sacred and profane very much, how much there's a fluidity between the two and stuff. I mean, and I want to just say this. I also think she can bring a younger audience back to the Catholic Church. Go ahead.
The judge, who's the Italian rapper, right, who's her coach now, who has the tattoos and the sleeves, you know, his commitment is once the show's over, he's going to go to the convent and talk about spirituality. He's interested in this. So it's not even, you know, because the question is, well, is she doing this in order to save people or whatnot? And so just by her authenticity and her integrity, she has people who probably would have no interest at all actually, you know, curious about, you know, how can you be who you are and do what you do? And they're willing to actually go and have that conversation. I think it's absolutely.
Well, you know, the thing about her is you hit the nail on the head before. You talk about how joyful she is. And Francis, not to sound like a Catholic nerd, but when that Joy of the Gospel that he wrote, the first 20 pages are all about joy,
absolutely,
joy, joy.
Absolutely.
And you think, give me some of that. And she's doing the same thing. Whatever she's got, you know, I don't have the voice, I'll take the happiness and the joy
part.
It's
a charismatic, you know, she's a Catholic charismatic. she really is. And you don't see very much of that. And not very much of that is applauded and considered authentic religion. But I have to say, it would be very, very hard for me to judge her because I would have to cross myself each time and say, Sister, I mean, I just feel like I'd be damned to hell if I say, Sister Christina, I didn't quite like that. You didn't hit that.
That's
note.
Right.
Well, you know
that's
who did like it, though? We've mentioned what's in the videos. And by the way, we can post some of them on our website, and you'll get to see them later in the day. The thing that I love beyond her, the quality of her singing and her dancing, is on the side, there are three nuns.
Yes.
All
right.
of whom are older. Yes. None of whom can dance.
That's right.
All of whom are so excited. You know when
that's
people,
right.
you go to a concert and people applaud with out of tune, out of sync with the music. They're all doing that, but they're the happiest three nuns on the planet.
Really?
It really is. It's
wonderful.
Is amazing. It is a great scene.
And you know what gives us joy about it? The whole thought that you can say joy and religion in the same voice.
Exactly.
Really?
Exactly.
Okay. And get excited, even to the point that you may even think about showing up for church on Sunday. How about that?
So before you two go, in a couple of minutes, we're going to open the phone lines and ask our listeners what they think about a Supreme Court decision just a couple of days ago about a city council. Was it a city council? I think it was a city council.
Yeah.
That opened every meeting.
Or town council.
Town council. Opened every. Do you have it in front of you, Marjorie?
Opened no,
every,
I do not.
Okay. Opened every meeting with the not the pledge. With what's it called? With the
prayer.
With the prayer. Yeah, with the prayer. And they ultimately decided that it was perfectly constitutional, that there was not a problem. And considering we're talking to two reverends here, Irene Monroe, starting with you.
County commissioners.
County commissioners. Thank you very much. What was your take on that decision,
Irene? I thought it was wrong. Hearted and wrong-headed.
Why?
I thought it was a gang of five there on the Supreme Court that are Catholic that voted in favor of it. I think it's a violation of church and state. This is not the first time the Supreme Court has made a mistake. I think it doesn't reflect the pluralistic society that we presently live in and embrace. So I thought it was really a backwards move. But I just need to say this, though. I was trying to figure out, what percentage of Americans, you know, think about, really want this. And interestingly enough, 75% really want an opening prayer before.
Do want. And by the way, the thing, Emmett, that put me over the edge, because I was not surprised either. It was 5-4, which almost everything is. It was 5-4, I think it was, is after the ruling, a commissioner from Carroll County in Maryland that Marjorie was mentioning said the ruling, quote, shuts down this so-called separation of church and state. That was in many ways to me more troubling, even though he has no formal power, than the five justices who said that there was a separation of church and state, but this did not violate it.
Yeah, I mean, the whole problem with this conversation, and there are so many models around the country of how to do this. I mean, you know, you can open a lot of places where the city council, the town councils will invite different clergy folks from different,
Boston,
you know.
Does
Boston does a great job at inviting a plethora of different beliefs and spiritual, you know, convictions.
Right, these
to
were
open
Christian
up.
Themed. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Yeah, overwhelmingly.
I mean, there's so much here. you know. But I think the decision was just wrong.
You know, I misspoke, by the way. I should be clear. Just one thing I read. We discussed this with the listeners last week. The variation on the theme that we're going to talk about, very quick thoughts from each of you in a couple of minutes, is our own state's highest court, the SJC, ruled that it was perfectly fine for the under God to remain in the Pledge of Allegiance, which they say is voluntary, and that there was no proven bullying or discrimination against anybody in the Acton-Boxborough Regional School District. How about that, Irene Monroe?
Well, you know, I'm a little disturbed by that, too. In the voice of, he's gone on, Christopher Hitchens, you know, it doesn't allow, wiggle room for folks who are atheists, and as he say, not only atheists, but anti-theist. And so, again, if we want to reflect a society that is, you know, crawling towards modernity, I think that we have to. I think we can think outside of this narrow box.
How about it, Emmett Price?
I mean, I'm fine with it because I think I've heard it articulated that it's more tradition than it is religion, and that as a you know, traditional statement or creed or whatnot, that I think the spirit is there. I mean, clearly the founders of the colonies, you know, had some Christian proclivities, if not, you know, unanimously. So I think it's in that heritage.
Wasn't this language we've discussed, wasn't this inserted 54. During the Eisenhower administration?
That's right.
It was inserted then, but the undertone of where the statement comes from is from
I don't think that's good enough, and I don't think a discussion, you know, an argument that because it's tradition is the reason why we ought to keep something, because society is fluid. We're a dynamic society.
Sure.
And so a lot of stuff that we would do out of tradition, we have undone.
But we're talking about something like the Star Spangled Banner or singing America the Beautiful.
But see, my point is you can do that and still not have under God as part of that whole framework. So I just totally disagree. Also, interestingly enough, those who are atheists pretend to be a younger generation. So you have millennials who are very much anti-religion, anti-God. Also, and get at the whole notion that when we say God, it engenders, for a lot of people, unfortunately, a white male. No offense.
Jim.
No,
we haven't spoken.
I thought you were calling him God.
Don't you think
Jim,
he looks a little... with the hair, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Kind of a godlike.
I can tell you, Emmett and I are confused all the time by people. Good to see you.
Thank you very much for coming in. The Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated columnist. You can find her at Bay Windows in the Huffington Post. Reverend Emmett Price says he's unusual. You can probe into that a little bit more next week. He's a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Thanks, you guys, for coming in. As always, thank you, Irene. See you later. Up next, we're going to ask you about what we were just talking about with Irene and Emmett, the Pledge of Allegiance. Massachusetts' highest court has ruled that the pledge does not discriminate against atheists. How do you feel about this ruling? We'll take your calls next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
All this month, the WGBH Spring Auction is your chance to bid on vacations, the latest electronics, fine dining experiences, rare collectibles, and even a brand new Toyota Avalon Hybrid XLE Premium, courtesy of your New England Toyota dealer. And every winning bid supports the news you trust and the programs you love. Special thanks to Rhodes Scholar, this year's premier sponsor. Place your bids online at auction.wgbh.org.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you and State Street, partnering with institutional investors worldwide to create the way ahead. Proud to support Innovation Hub, Saturday at 10 a.m. and in the Innovation Block each Thursday at 9 p.m. on 89.7 WGBH. And the Boston Pops, presenting Warren Haynes at Symphony Hall in a Jerry Garcia symphonic celebration, performing classics of Garcia and the Grateful Dead, May 13th and 14th at Symphony Hall. BostonPops.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And Massachusetts' highest court, as we told you a minute ago, has ruled that the Pledge of Allegiance does not discriminate against atheists, saying that the words under God represent a patriotic, not a religious exercise. We want to know where you are on this at 877-301 8970. Atheists, if you're out there, we'd love to hear from you at that number. Do you feel discriminated against, or do you agree that this is more about patriotism than it is about religious belief? It was a unanimous court, Marjorie. Everybody agreed. Chief Justice Roderick Ireland, who's retiring, I think, next month, actually, yep. Mandatory retirement because of age. The daily recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance does not violate Article 1 of the Massachusetts Declaration of Rights. But they go on to say that there was no evidence that someone's rights had been violated. There was no evidence that someone had been bullied or discriminated against. And they say the fact that it's voluntary, which doesn't move me very much, is also a critical ingredient. And I have to say, I think they have no comprehension of what bullying and discrimination are. I'll give you an example that is not perfectly the same, but I would argue it's a much more mild one and it caused problem. When I was a kid going to school and kids would sing Christmas songs.
Right.
I'm Jewish.
Yep.
I love Christmas songs. I was in exultation because they were my favorite songs. A couple of my friends who were Jewish, by the way, felt totally uncomfortable. Were they discriminated against? Were they bullied? I don't think so. But there was a deep level of discomfort, and they were much more religious than I was. So the court deciding that because there was no overt bullying, because there was no overt discrimination that they suffered, doesn't speak to the level of discomfort that is created. And as we both said, Emmett Price, a few minutes ago, this is a relatively new phenomenon. A lot of people think, well, this has been in the Pledge of Allegiance forever. No, it was added in the 50s. And why was it added in the 1950s?
Well, because it was McCarthy hearings.
Exactly.
It was all about being the Red Scare, as that time period was called. You know, Roderick Ireland writes something that's very interesting when he says that just because someone feels stigmatized or excluded does not mean the program or activity necessarily violates equal protection principle. So it's a very narrow place he's coming down on, but it, you know, that's a point. I mean, does feeling stigmatized or excluded violate those equal protection principles? So I could see both sides of this. I mean, as we just said, it's only been there since 1954. It was added in during a very bad time to kind of prove to everybody that in addition to being a totally patriotic American, you were supposedly a totally God-fearing patriotic American, which is problematic. But sometimes I think in these cases, too, that for parents that bring these kinds of suits, and this is an atheist family on behalf of their kids, I get why they did it. On the other hand, maybe as a parent, the teaching moment is to say, you know, everybody is different. Everybody has different beliefs.
I agree with you.
And this is not, I don't know if I were the mother or father, I'd want to go to
But wait
court.
A second. Let's assume the mother and father do exactly, in the hypothetical case, not this one, exactly what you suggest. And
yep.
Say, everybody has different beliefs. You're going to tolerate theirs, they'll tolerate yours. You don't think that the kid, even if trained properly and led properly by the parents, could feel socially marginalized at school? You think when the Pledge of Allegiance happens and the kid standing next to you, I'm only thinking back, it was a different time,
right.
When the kid next to me didn't say the words under God, you could hear his voice
yep.
next to you or her voice saying everything else except under God. You can't imagine a situation, particularly in the era of heightened bullying, where a kid could be treated
I would say
in a discriminatory way because of his or her decision?
You have to be very careful on both sides, because I remember going to school with Jehovah's Witnesses who did not recite the pledge at all. And the teacher made it very clear, and I was only a little kid, that they, in their religion, they did not recite the pledge. And so everybody said, okay, they're Jehovah's Witnesses, they don't recite the pledge. I mean, it was not a big deal to us as children. And I think it's significant and a credit to Acton that in the Acton school system where these kids did not recite the pledge with the words under God, and maybe they didn't recite the pledge at all, that they were not bullied or harassed. So,
but it doesn't mean that they didn't feel marginalized, that they didn't feel things that didn't rise to the level of bullying. I mean, you know, and instantly, Barbara Lank, who is one of the
reason kids are bullied.
What's that?
This is the reason.
Wait,
kids
you can't imagine a situation where someone sets themselves apart on an issue like this, standing.
No,
I can.
I can see other things, sort of being heavy. That's
way. I'm telling you right now, as a kid who was heavy,
yep.
teachers said exactly what you said they should say. And I still was treated as a second class citizen. The teacher said, it doesn't matter what your body shape is.
Right.
Doesn't matter if you're tall or small. We're all the same. And the heavy kids all got bullied. Not bullied, but at least I wasn't bullied.
I guess what I'm saying, Jim, is that's kind of the reason people get bullied for those kinds of things.
You know what they get bullied for? For being different. and for being different. And in a situation like this, I'm not saying it's widespread. I have obviously, if there was hard evidence here, they would have presented. I'm just saying the notion that there is not potential for marginalization, at least.
Yeah.
It's also unnecessary. If it turns
it is
out,
unnecessary.
Say
I don't think
it without.
Should,
and if someone wants to mouth the words on their own,
right
then
on
they
that
mouth
part.
Them.
You're right on that part. It doesn't need to be there. Just like I don't think the prayers before the meetings seem to be there. But it's just, I also get upset when schools, districts have to pay all this money.
No, I'm with you on that. $60,000 you know, that should have been spent on a teacher. That part I agree with you on.
Okay,
let's go to the calls.
877-301-8970 is our number. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Dave from East Boston. What do you think, Dave?
Hey, guys.
Hi, Dave.
I think that it should not be included in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Why?
For the simple fact that, I mean, there is the concept of separation of church and state for a reason. Even though we don't necessarily practice it all that well in this country, it is there for a reason. And, of course, with the rise of atheism and, you know, just other, you know, different religions who, you know, their gods take different forms. I mean, you have to account for that.
Dave, I'm going to argue against myself here. The difference between this on that count and the decision by the Supreme Court of the United States, which we talked about the prayer in front of that county commissioner meeting in Maryland, that was had a decidedly Christian slant. It was not. There was not. It was not neutral. It was not. It was not multi kind of religion. Here, it is neutral. It's just under God. It's not under Jesus or this one. But the question about whether or not it makes people who are not religious or anti-religious feel excluded is one that Marjorie and I seem to differ with, even though I agree with you in terms of the bottom line. Dave, thanks for the call. Luke, you're in Framingham. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Luke.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I was calling in because I attended the oral argument in this case.
Oh, great.
I wanted to commend you, especially Jim, for pointing out that, you know, this isn't the typical First Amendment separation of church and state argument. This is an equal protection argument.
Right.
You know, the point is whether or not the kids are bullied for not saying those words, the idea is the experience of being excluded from that portion of that patriotic exercise by your deeply held belief basically says to you there's a line between patriotic God believers and unpatriotic non-God believers to some extent. And so whether or not, you know, that's true, I think that's the argument, and it doesn't depend on whether any actual bullying goes on.
Why were you there, by the way, Luke?
Just out of academic interest. I'm just finishing up my third year at Suffolk Law School, and I'm the editor-in-chief of the Suffolk Journal of Trial and Appellate Advocacy.
So that's
good for you.
Hey, Luke,
yeah.
When you heard the oral argument, if I had asked you to predict what's the ruling going to be, would you have guessed unanimity?
Likely. And by the tone, tenor, and substance of the questions especially, leading off, Chief Justice Ireland asked the lawyer for the people who were challenging the inclusion of under God rather pointedly, now, did you hear what they opened this court session with? And the lawyer said yes, but Chief Justice Ireland said no. Well, could you repeat it, please? And they opened the court session with God save the Commonwealth. So after, you know, getting the lawyer to say that, he said, now, is that an equal protection violation? And so I thought, you know, that question was rather telling to start off with, and very few of the questions really had much sympathy for the point of view of the appellees here.
But, Luke, when you said it was decided wrong, it's pretty clear that, in Ireland's opinion, the fact that there was no evidence of punishment, bullying, or other mistreatment or criticism or anything else was a big deal, and that was a big part of his decision. Why are you saying it was decided wrong?
I think that was too big a part of his decision.
Okay.
I think the way to look at it is it's the experience of having to say a truncated version of this patriotic exercise in order to be true to your deeply held beliefs that draws the classification between God believers who can be patriotic and say the full pledge and non-God believers who, if they're going to be true to themselves, have to refrain from what is, you know, from their perspective, a patriotic exercise. So whether or not that bullying goes on, I think that that experience itself provides more than sufficient evidence of the fact that an invidious classification is being drawn here one that's unnecessary and that there's no justification for.
I think you should go be a lawyer, Luke. That was very impressive.
Hey, Luke, that was great. Thank you. By the way,
he's ready today.
Luke complimented me for distinguishing this from the Supreme Court case. I didn't do it one-tenth as well as he did. Supreme Court case we were talking about a minute ago about prayer was about separation of church and state. This is about Article 1 of the Massachusetts Declaration of Rights, and that is the state constitutional provision, which is the equal rights provision, as
right.
Luke said, as I said, far better than I. Let's go to Ryan. Luke, thank you for the call. Good luck being a lawyer. Let's go to Ryan. He's in North Attleboro. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Ryan.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
All right, so I graduated from high school 2 years ago, actually, so I could probably shed some light on what it's like in schools
Good.
Recently.
Do it.
So I was... I would consider myself an atheist during high school, very much anti-theistic, as it was put earlier in your show. But interestingly enough, I actually never really faced any issues with not vocalizing the word God in the Pledge of Allegiance. In fact, that was the general solution that people would take, including teachers. They usually just refrain from saying the word God. Now, that was at my school. My friend's school, on the other hand, which was in town, because I went to a vocational school, he had issues. He got issues not just for the Pledge of Allegiance with God, but also the shirts he'd wear, which sometimes, you know, punk rock shirts, they have the, some anti-religious stuff on there, but not overt. More they imply, I guess you could say. And the other thing that I'd say that kind of discrimination you might see in some schools is how that school, they would allow a Bible class or a school group, but they wouldn't allow an atheist group.
Wow.
And also, at my school, the issue with the Pledge of Allegiance wasn't over God, but it was more of actually saying it. They would make you say it, and you would get in trouble if you did not.
Well, and by the way, and well, that was a great call too, Ryan.
That's over the top.
Right. One of the things that they rested their decision on here, beyond the fact that there was no proven bullying or overt discrimination, was the fact that in the Attleboro-Boxboro schools in question, that it was a voluntary recitation. Hey, Ryan, that was another great call, and thank
I'm
you for the call.
And I'm also surprised a public school would even allow a Bible study group. I mean, that seems just over the top as well.
We were done, but we actually have to take one more because this call is from Acton and actually was involved in this in some fashion. Jonathan, you're calling from Acton. What was your connection to this, Jonathan?
Hello.
Hi.
I taught school in Acton for 30 years.
Yeah.
And I used to lead the pledge every Monday morning in eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I didn't say that. Sometimes I didn't say unto God, and sometimes out of habit, I just slipped up and said it after years of saying that, I think, when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But I tried to explain to kids, especially in the last 10 years, that it's more about the flag, because, you know, I told them that a lot of people, not much older than them, were dying in other countries and everything in wars, and that at least we could do is get on our feet and do something to show a little respect.
Well, that's essentially, Jonathan, thanks for the call and the connection. That's essentially where Judge Justice Ireland ended up. Jonathan, thanks for the call.
Okay. Up next, writer Michael Pollan. Can't wait to talk to him. He's the man who's been credited with leading the modern-day food movement to eat local, to eat healthy, and to keep it simple. He's discovered the joys of cooking within his own kitchen. It's the subject of his latest book. Michael Pollan joins us next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
What goes into a great commencement speech?
It has to be authentic. It has to be real. You have to believe what you're saying because people will get it if you don't.
I'm on campus reporter Kirk Carapeza with a behind-the-scenes look at commencement speeches this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you and the Lowell Institute, sponsoring free public lectures since 1839, including Key Issues, Election 2014, May 14th, presented by Cambridge Forum at the First Parish Church, Cambridge. More at lowellinstitute.org. And Dover Rug and Home, rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's spring event in Natick or at doverrug.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is a man who has given us some simple directives when it comes to eating a healthy diet. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Now, for those of you who took this a step further to adopt the raw food diet, you can pull your oven mitt out of storage. Journalist Michael Pond's latest book is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Michael, it's great to meet you.
Thanks, Jim. Good to be here.
Well, this is a great book. And I was just saying before we went on the air that I get criticized all the time by my children who read, my oldest daughter particularly, who reads all your books about everything I'm doing wrong when she comes home. But you talk about how we should get, that we should cook, that we shouldn't live our lives at the hot bar at Whole Foods or running down to a Trader Joe's, whatever it is. Why should we cook, Michael Pollan?
Well, it's the only way to take control of your diet. If you're having people prepare your food who are large industrial corporations who really don't, are not interested in your health, they're really interested in just selling you food, they're not going to cook as well as you can cook for yourself or loved ones can cook for you. So, the longer I looked at the whole question of nutrition and what we should be eating, I discovered to my surprise that it wasn't about finding the good or evil nutrient, that's a trap and doesn't really work. It really is the best predictor of a healthy diet is whether it was cooked by a human being or a big corporation.
You know, and you mentioned as a formerly round little child, which I was, as Marjorie knows, I've told many times, the connection to obesity here, and particularly child, is so direct. The causal connection is huge.
The parallels are, and in fact, this was determined by a Harvard economist, David Cutler, who looked at this, and he tracked the obesity epidemic to the decline in home cooking. And the two things are in lockstep, beginning around really 1980 or so. And the reason is that when you don't cook meals, people end up snacking and they end up eating food that's been engineered to get you to eat too much of it. I mean, you know, the food industry has a strong interest in getting you to eat more than you should. It's a tough industry. The margins are small. The population is growing at a not as high a rate as Wall Street wants these companies to grow. There is the fixed stomach. How much food can a human eat? And they work very hard to expand the fixed stomach and get us to eat more. So, and they do it by layering salt, fat, and sugar. And when you put these things together, food becomes really addictive.
Well, one of the things I think that some people think, especially moms and dads do cook more, but I think moms are mostly doing the cooking and you're working full time and
stuff.
Which is
a problem, but we can get to that.
It is a problem. Yeah. One of the things you try to do is, okay, I'm going to go to a bakery and buy really good bread that's not full of high fructose corn syrup, even if it's expensive, yeah. If I can afford to do it, which I do actually. I go buy this great bakery, or I'll go to like a Whole Foods where I think that there's not going to be so much junk in the foods and the meat's not going to be full of steroids and all these antibiotics and terrible things. But I'm buying it a lot of the time prepared to save time.
Mm.
And I thought that was a good thing. And you've burst my bubble, Michael Pollan.
You know, I think time is really what stands between a lot of people and their desire to cook.
Yeah.
Also, a loss of confidence and a sense
of not
having skills. And I think that's too bad because it's really not rocket science. I mean, we watch these cooking shows on television that makes it look really intimidating. Like, I can't cook like that. But the goal is not to make restaurant food at home. That's special occasion stuff. But I think we do feel pressed on time. However, I just encourage people to look at how they are spending their time. We find time for the things we deem important. And over the last 15 years, we've all found 2 hours in the day to surf the internet. Like, where did that come from? It's still a 24-hour day. Well, we took some from television. We decided that was more important. And my argument is that this is really important. There's nothing more important to your health, your family's health, or the social life of your family. Because if you cook, people will sit down together and have a meal and talk.
So wait a second. Come on, Michael Pollan. You're legendary. But if given the choice between watching The Good Wife, then watching Mad Men, and then having DVR'd Veep and watching that after, you'd actually cook something instead.
Game of Thrones, Jim.
No, that I'm not watching. You know, what stunned a lot of people when your book came out, and I was amongst them because we're all Michael Pollan adherents, is the fact that you were not a big-time cook is sort of stunning. I mean, it isn't that you misled us, but the feeling was you can't be that good about how to be healthy and all these kinds of things. And not be. So how did that happen?
Yeah.
Where was the disconnect?
I did cook. I mean, we cooked probably more nights than we didn't, but I wasn't a very good cook, and I didn't give it much thought. It was one of those subjects. There it is, cooking, big deal. What's there to say about it? It was really when I learned how important it was, both on the health side and on the environmental side, frankly. We're not going to change our food system if people insist on corporate cooked food, because corporations will buy food from the biggest monoculture farms. So I did cook, but I cook kind of thoughtlessly. And for me, the journey of discovery in this book was like getting better at it and learning what it's all about. And then it's a very profound transformation that we do, moving these things from nature to culture.
We want to talk about how you learned and the process you write about. But you mentioned the big agri-farms. A good friend of mine has been the head of FarmAid for 25 years. And obviously talking about small family farmers. That's
good organization.
Where is that? In the Cambridges of the world where I live, in the Brooklines where Marjorie lives, in the Berkeleys where you live, I'm assuming it's center stage.
Yeah.
How center stage across America is that whole movement?
Well, there is a local food movement that's all over the country now. It's bigger in some places than others, but you can go to Iowa and you find, which is corn and soy land, which used to be a place, it was a food desert actually. There was no real food in Iowa. All the corn and soy was shipped out of state, processed into meat and fast food and sent back in. It was like a third world country. But now there's local food. There are people who are taking some of their acreage out of corn and soybeans and growing vegetables and selling them locally. So this is becoming a national movement. It's still small. It's got a long way to go. But it's got legs. And so I'm very encouraged by what I see going on. It's not just a coastal phenomenon. And it's not just an elite phenomenon. It's happening in inner cities as well.
We talked with Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and Cooking as well. So you touched on two things I think are a big problem. Mothers working very long hours and having no confidence in their abilities. So what do you tell the people that are listening right now that are in that boat? What should they do?
Well, I think a big problem with cooking was it was women's work. And it was a ghetto, basically. And it was denigrated as not being that important. And when women entered the workforce, there was enormous tension over that in families, in my family. And there was this very charged, uncomfortable conversation between men and women about how do we divide how do we divide labor at home? There was cooking, there was childcare, there was cleaning. And as you know, it was very tense. And what happened with cooking is the industry, which had been trying to get in the American kitchen for 100 years, leapt forward and say, hey, stop arguing, we've got you covered. We'll cook for you. And it let men off the hook, and it let women off the hook, and we didn't finish that conversation. That's what we need to do now, because we need to get everybody in the kitchen, and most importantly, children. Because if they leave home without that critical life skill, I think it's irresponsible to let your kids graduate from school or college not knowing how to just roast a chicken, make 10 things, some tiny, simple repertoire. It's so important, and especially for boys. We need home ec again.
Yeah, we've talked about that a lot, about how to be great for boys and girls. You're an anti-microwave kind of guy, aren't you?
I love microwaves for reheating a cup of tea.
They are great at that.
And frozen things. It's great for that. Cooking in a microwave?
Awful.
Doesn't work.
So tell us what you did. You divide your thing into fire, water, what were the other two things?
Air and earth.
Okay.
The classical elements.
Okay, the fire thing, which because you dealt with some of the great barbecue masters of the world. Tell us a little bit. North Carolina, is that us about this.
Well, fire is the first kind of cooking. It goes back 2 million years. It changed us as a species. It is the reason that we developed these big brains and small guts compared to other primates. It was a big deal in our evolution. So I wanted to find the existing most primal kind of cooking there is. And that turns out to be whole hog barbecue as practiced in Eastern North Carolina. Western North Carolina, they do pork shoulders. The barbecue Balkans, and it's highly divided all through the South. So I found a couple pit masters, one in particular named Ed Mitchell, who was in Raleigh at the time. Now he's in Durham. And he was cooking the way people had been cooking meat for hundreds of years. It's a 20-hour process, a lot of sitting around and drinking while it goes on. It grew out of the tobacco harvest in the South. It's what you did while you were you had these fires to cure the tobacco. It was one of the few times that black and white sat down together to eat. And he said that in his experience, Ed Mitchell said that the two most integrated things in his life and the most profound things was Vietnam and barbecue. That's where the racial lines were crossed. And it remains one of the few places. I mean, even at the height of race tension in the South, if the good barbecue was at a black place, the whites would be there and vice versa.
So what can Michael Pollan do on the barbecue front that he couldn't do prior to his encounters with pitmasters?
Well, I learned, you know, for me, barbecuing, what I called barbecuing, was grilling things, you know, 5-10 minutes, hot temperature, take it on and take it off. What I learned is slowing down and cooking slowly over fire, you get amazing results. And so most of us cook way too hot. And so I learned to turn down the heat or let the coals, if I was using coals, burn all the way down. And then I put on the meat or whatever I was doing. And that kind of gentle cooking, I'm talking about 200 to 250 degrees. And you put it on and you leave it on most of the day. And you get the most sublime results.
We talked about how women, there's a sex divide. Women are braisers and men are grillers.
Yeah. Well, you know, grilling, I mean, the real secret of grilling that men don't let people in on is it's really easy. It's really A-B. Anybody can do it.
Yeah.
But we like to self-dramatize. And pit masters and even backyard barbecuers are always just kind of, they have their, you know, they're, it's a show. And women are a little more, don't need that when they're cooking. And so they cook in pots where, of course, it's much less visible. It's very hard to make a big show about a stew the way, you know, you can take a joint of meat and flames. And so that's why guys have always been into barbecue and will continue to be. They're also into baking, I found. That was another macho area of cooking that I learned about. And it tends to be male-dominated. Pastry chefs are women, but bread bakers are guys.
Really?
Yeah. Well, you know, think about it. You make this highly visible thing that gets much bigger as you cook. Enough said.
Okay.
Your current book, the book, it's out in paperback. It's called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. My advice for your next book is bugged. And the reason this, we had a discussion the other day about how there is a bug movement, which you're probably aware of.
I am.
Much better for the environment, apparently. Much less use of water, those sort of things. Much higher protein content as a percentage of the thing.
And
is that happening? I mean,
it's happening in a little way. There's a big taboo for us to get over. I have a student, actually, who just finished a great piece on crickets, and they're making energy bars out of crickets. And I tried them, and they're good, but the idea is a little gross. But we need to remember, especially here in New England, that lobsters were treated as bugs for 100 years, and people were really disgusted. In fact, there was a law in Massachusetts that you could only feed lobster to prisoners like 2 times a week because they wanted to do it every day. And it was considered brutal. So maybe we'll come around. Sushi, eating raw fish, is a taboo we overcame. You know, I'm not eager to do it, but yeah, it might be a good idea.
So what trends are on the horizon that either you'll be writing about or we'll be reading about in the New York Times or the Boston Globe or the Herald or something? What's next?
You know, I don't really have a crystal ball. You know, I think kale's moment has probably passed. And not a moment
too soon.
Some of us
missed it, yeah.
No, I mean, kale was fine, but we were eating too much of it. And I don't know what the next hot vegetable will be. You know, I come from Berkeley.
We're into Brussels sprouts here.
Well, I'm a big Brussels sprouts.
Oh, yeah. No, they're big.
They're big.
Yeah. So I don't really have a crystal ball.
You know,
I'm
Michael Pollan, in the back of your book, Cooked, you have a short shelf of books on cooking. If people are listening out here that want tips on how to take back the kitchen, learn how to cook some simple meals, are there one or two that you could recommend?
You know, I really like Mark Bittman's books.
I mean, too.
He's a good friend. How to Cook Anything is, that's my go-to, and it simplifies things. He doesn't mystify. For example, the best thing I learned from Mark Bittman was rice. You can cook rice like pasta. You don't have to measure the water precisely. Just boil it in a ton of water, and when it tastes right, empty it into a colander. And I was like, oh, that takes a lot of anxiety out of rice cooking.
See, that causes me anxiety. It's the exact opposite.
I love that.
If I can't measure it and I have to use, I don't want to use judgment. And I know when you're a good cook, you have to use, but that really, even you saying the words is anxiety provoking for me, Michael.
What's the hard part here?
Because you have to figure out when it's really right. If it turns out
you
follow the directions.
Well, one of the keys to cooking is tasting constantly.
Yes.
That is how you really learn to cook. At every stage, and you watch how things change, and you salt it a little bit and taste it before you salt it more. When I watch, I spend a lot of time in restaurant kitchens watching chefs, and that really is the key, tasting everything along the way. And if you do that, you know when it's ready.
Okay. So Mark Bittman, How to Cook Everything. Is there one more?
I think the Alice Waters books, The Art of Simple Eating, there are 2 volumes of that. It's very straightforward, and she's, you know, she's a wonderful cook.
And when you learn how to do it, you can do it much faster.
Yeah, I don't spend that much time cooking. I mean, maybe 30 minutes at night. And a couple of the ways I've dealt with time is I always make at least 50% more than we're going to eat. So I always
save
have
it.
Leftovers.
Yep.
We need to rebrand the leftover. I think leftovers are great. And that's one way. If you're going to cook, might as well make enough food for two meals.
Can we get back to the microwave thing for just one
yeah.
second? I know how, as a person who from time to time has done the microwave thing, I know how horrible. I read the contents. Is anybody working on a frozen meal that actually, I know there's Whole Food is not quite as bad, some of those,
yeah.
but why can't they breed, which is the wrong verb, for example, the sodium content is just
yeah.
absolutely, and I
out
assume it's a preservation thing. Isn't
yeah.
science ready to do something that's not going to kill us that reduces the sodium content, a frozen meal?
Food science may be able to make processed food better than it is now, and there's certainly a lot of work on salt and ways to increase the perception of salt with less salt by changing the molecular structure,
mm-hmm.
and I hope they figure it out. But for now, those frozen meals are just salt bombs and fat bombs, and not to mention they don't taste very good. I mean, if you actually pay attention to how they taste,
right.
they all have good first bites. They've been engineered for the first bite, but the law of diminishing marginal utility sets in, and by the fifth bite, you're kind of disgusted.
Michael, where are you in the late, I was going to say the late great Michael Bloomberg, he's not dead, but he's no longer the mayor. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
Whether
soda cups?
It's the 16-ounce thing,
yeah.
he was also had a salt crusade, which
yeah.
I don't think went very far. What do you think about public initiatives on these fronts? Marjorie and I fight about them all the time.
I think we need to try them. I think, we have a serious problem in this country. The adult onset diabetes is now type 2 diabetes because kids are getting
yeah.
it now. There were no kids with this disease just in 1980.
And gluten intolerance, too.
And gluten intolerance is another problem. We need to experiment. We should try a soda tax somewhere. If it works, great. If it reduces soda consumption and rates of diabetes, great. And if it doesn't, throw it out. What Bloomberg was doing was the mildest kind of social engineering. This is nudge, politics.
Did you hear this,
right?
Marjorie? Nudge politics.
Which is non-coercive. And you're basically making tweaks to the environment to encourage people to think twice before they go to that second 16 ounces. I think Bloomberg made a mistake in the way he introduced it. He should have been talking about children. You can't make that
Great
nanny
point.
State argument about kids. Kids need nannies. So I wish we had tried it to see if it worked.
Michael, it's great
Michael,
to see you.
Thank
great
you for
to be
being
here
with us.
Thank
Michael
you.
Pollan's latest book is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. It's now out in paperback. He'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight. The event is sold out, but some of his books are still on the shelves. Thank you for being.
It's actually a First Parish Church tonight.
Oh,
it's
First Parish Church.
It's
Harvard
Square.
That's okay.
Yeah.
First Parish Church
yeah.
in Harvard Square. I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for listening today, and please tune in again tomorrow. Our show is a production of WGBH.